First of all, anyone not get a copy of the outline that was in the bluish type folder? If you don't have one, raise your hand. We'll get one out to you, and it will not have one of these outlines. We did good. Our series for this week is entitled The Call of the Prophets. So what I want to focus on is some key people within the Bible called to a prophetic office. As we'll see, some were anxious to be called, some were not so anxious, and some were objecting even after they were called and were a prophet for a while. And this morning we'll focus on Moses on page 1. Tonight we'll deal with Isaiah on page 2. Then Monday night we'll deal with Jeremiah. On Tuesday we'll deal with Ezekiel. And on Wednesday, we'll combine the last two prophets together, Daniel and Hosea, and note how differently they each respond in the nature of their prophetic office. Let's turn now then to our Bibles to Exodus chapter 3. The book of Genesis provides the origins of the Jewish people, and by the time the book of Genesis ends, the people of Israel number about 70 to 75 people strong, and they have moved down to Egypt. In the Genesis, they do rather well in Egypt. But the book of Exodus opens up with the fact there's a new dynasty over Egypt, not just a new king, also a new dynasty, that did not recognize the benefits of Joseph to the Egyptian kingdom. As a result, by the end of chapter 1, there is enslavement and attempt at genocide. In chapter 2, we're given the brief account of the infancy of Moses up until the age of 40. At the age of 40, he finds himself having to flee the land of Egypt, and he spends 40 more years outside the land, probably called to the prophetic office only at the age of 80. Dr. Charles Feinberg, who was a professor of Hebrew at Talbot Seminary, once said, I don't know if he originated it or not, he said, for the first 40 years, God showed Moses what he could do with a man who thought he was something. The second 40 years, God showed Moses what he could do with a man who thought he was nothing. In the third 40 years, he showed we could do a man who learned both lessons well. And so now, after 40 years of somethingness and 40 years of nothingness, he gets his call. Now, the theological or covenantal basis for the call comes out at the end of chapter 2, verse 23. Chapter 2, verse 23. And it came to pass in the course of those many days that the king of Egypt died. The children of Israel sighed by reason of the bondage, and they cried, and the cry came up unto God by reason of the bondage. And God heard their groanings, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God saw the children of Israel, and he took knowledge of them. Now the call of Moses, so it begins in chapter 3, is based upon God's covenantal relationship with the Jewish people, and the covenant specifically is the Abrahamic covenant. And when God signed and sealed the Abrahamic covenant back in Genesis chapter 15, he pointed out that he will not give them the land right away. The iniquity of the Amorite is not yet full. What he will do instead is have them wander in different parts. They'll be enslaved for a while. And only after a period of enslavement will they finally come out. And so now the period of enslavement is to be complete and full. And it's time to bring them out. Now, verse 24 says, God remembered his covenant. Now, keep in mind that sometimes the word remember is in contrast to forgetting. That's not the case here, obviously. An omniscient God cannot forget anything. And every remembrance is very vivid. But sometimes the word remember means the in the sense of taking action upon. And so now he'll begin acting upon the promise he made in the Abrahamic covenant. Not in the sense that he forgot all about it for so long. But it says God took knowledge of them. There's two different Hebrew words for knowledge, which will play a role a bit later in our study this morning. But the word for knowledge here is experiential knowledge. Obviously, God knew the situation from day one. But now he takes special experiential knowledge of them as part of the deliverance. As we come to your outline, capital A, the burning bush, in chapter 3, verses 1 through 5. And the occasion we're given is that while Moses was feeding the flock, which, by the way, was a degrading job for Egyptians, as we see from Genesis chapter 46, verse 34. Genesis 46, 34, it's a degrading job for the Egyptians, but an honorable job for Semites like the Jewish family. It says they brought the flock to the back of the wilderness and came to Horeb. And Horeb is a mountain range. And within this mountain range is one mountain in particular, Mount Sinai, here called the Mountain of God. So sometimes you'll see in the text that is Horeb, referring to a mountain range, as sometimes Mount Sinai, one mount within the range. What happens in verse 2 is he gets a vision of the Shekinah glory. Because what he sees initially is a bush that's burning and burning, but doesn't seem to get burned away. Now, Sinai is a very dry desert area. There's very little rain that comes upon the Sinai. And there are scattered throughout the wadis of Sinai little bushes. Even modern-day Bedouins feed the flocks on these bushes. It's not unusual to see a bush suddenly catch fire and burn. So burning bushes in the Sinai is not all that unusual. But burning bushes to start talking to you and giving you orders, that is unusual even for the Sinai. And within the bush is the angel of Jehovah. And the angel of Jehovah is never a common, ordinary angel. Whenever you see this phrase, the angel of Jehovah, the angel of the Lord, there's always a title for the second person of the Trinity, one of his pre-incarnate appearances. And within the bush is the angel of Jehovah, and also a fire that burns but does not consume the bush. It is one of the appearances that we call the Shekhinah, or the Shekinah glory. And by definition, the Shekinah glory is the visible manifestation of God's presence. The visible manifestation of God's presence. And so whenever the invisible God became visible, and whenever his omnipresence was localized, this visible localized presence was the Shekinah glory. And through most of Old Testament history came either as a light or fire or cloud. Light, fire, cloud, or a combination of these three things. These were not the only appearances, but these were the primary ones. And this is the way God frequently appeared in visible form, as he does here. At the same time, the bush pictures the people of Israel and enslaved in Egypt, burning and burning without being consumed. And all the centuries of persecution against the Jews, what up to Nazi Holocaust, and what is yet to be in the future, it'll be like a burning bush. They'll burn and burn, but this will not be consumed. And Moses, in observing this bush not being destroyed in verse 3, begins to move towards it when he hears the voice out of the bush. And that's what it says. Jehovah saw that Moses turned aside to see, and God called him out of the midst of the bush. And this is a basic pattern you see frequently with the angel of the Lord. In one part of the passage is called the angel, but somewhere else in the passage, he'll be called Jehovah, he'll be called Elohim, a God. That's what happens in verse 3 and 4. The angel of the Lord is within the bush, and now God is speaking from within the bush, because this angel of the Lord is God himself in visible form. When he calls the attention of Moses, he doubles his name, Moses, Moses. And God did that frequently. For example, when he called Abraham in Genesis chapter 22, verse 1, he doubled his name. When God called Jacob in Genesis chapter 46, verse 2, he doubled his name. When God called Samuel in 1 Samuel chapter 3, verse 10, he doubled his name. New Testament, when God called Paul by his Hebrew name Saul, he doubled his name. And the command is, do not come any closer. Take off your shoes, because the land you're standing upon is holy ground. And with the presence of God on the earth, that section of the land now becomes holy, sanctified, and therefore the shoes of Moses must be removed. Now, Kapil Binyaratlan, he receives his commission in chapter 3, verses 6 to 10. And in verse 6, he again spells out the covenantal relationship. Moreover, he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, and the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And this is the formula for what we now simply call the Abrahamic covenant. And this is the quotation that Jesus gave the Sadducees when they came to him with the question about the resurrection. As many of you already know, there's a key difference between the Pharisees and Sadducees. And among these differences is that the Pharisees did believe in the future resurrection of the dead. The Sadducees did not. That's why they were sad, you see. And the Sadducees enjoyed asking Pharisees tricky questions to make them look stupid. And one day they tried to play one of the trick questions on Jesus and said to him, we know you're a very smart teacher, and we have a theological problem. Maybe you can solve it for us. Here's our problem. There was a couple that had seven children, seven sons, in fact. The oldest son married this one woman, but he dies with no children. So in keeping with the Mosaic law, the second son marries her, he too dies with no children. And then the third brother marries her, he too dies with no kids. As a result, all seven brothers were married to the same woman. All seven brothers died with no children. And after a while, she also passed away. Here's our dilemma. In the resurrection, which they did not believe in anyway, but never mind. In the resurrection, whose wife is she going to be? All seven were married to her. Now, personally, just between you and me, if the Sadducees had come to me with that question, my answer would have been quite different than the one that Jesus chose to give. In my case, I would have simply called for a grand jury investigation to find out, why are these guys dying off so soon after they married this one woman? What matter is it who she's going to be married to? Why are they dead to begin with? But Jesus chose to ignore that facet of the problem. Notice what he does not do. He does not quote three classic passages in the Old Testament that clearly teach a resurrection. He does not quote Daniel chapter 12, verse 2. He does not quote Isaiah 26, verse 19. He doesn't quote Job 19, verse 25 and 26. Those are your classic passages, but he does not quote them as a good reason. Another key difference between Pharisees and Sadducees was that the Pharisees believed you can derive doctrine from any part of the Hebrew Bible, be it the law, the prophets, or writings. Not so the Sadducees, who claimed all doctrine must originate from the five books of Moses. What the prophets and writings could be used to illustrate doctrine, but the origin must come from the five books of Moses. They could not find any such doctrine of five books of Moses, and therefore chose not to believe in the future resurrection. So for Jesus to quote the Job, Isaiah, or Daniel while authoritative for the Pharisees would not be authoritative for the Sadducees. So he quotes this verse right here, chapter 3, verse 6, and the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Again, a reference to the Abrahamic covenant, but when does covenant God ever promise a resurrection? It's found in a simple principle that if God makes a promise and the person dies before the promise is fulfilled, it obligates God to raise them back to life for a simple reason. Every promise of God must be fulfilled, and it must be fulfilled through one he made the promise to. And so, by that point of time, God made certain promises about Isaac not yet fulfilled. Abraham knew that if God had to kill Isaac, God raised him back to life. How did he know that? God didn't say he would do so. Because by then he knew God to be a promise-keeping God. And so if he killed Isaac, God raised him back to life. Because again, every promise must be fulfilled. It must be fulfilled to one he made the promise. So keep in mind, when he makes the promise to Abraham a covenant, that after a long time of wandering and a long time of enslavement, he will bring them back to land. Now the time has come. And someday there must be a resurrection of the patriarchs, because he did not only promise the land to their descendants. To all three men, he said, to you and to your seed I will give this land. And so in the final restoration, there'll be restored Israel, and there'll be the Old Testament saints resurrected, enjoying the land, for God to fulfill his promises. And so it's found here in verse 6, there's a lot more than merely a reference to the Abrahamic covenant. It shows God as a promise-keeping, covenant-keeping, and the evidence is about to happen with the Exodus. Now, Moses' response is to cover his face to make sure he does not see upon God a common experience of men who thought they were in the God's presence. This happened to Elijah at the mount where he saw the voice, so he heard the voice of God. And in verse 7, God spells out the compassion he has for Israel. I've seen the affliction of my people in Israel. I've heard their cry because of the taskmasters. I know their sorrow. So God's purpose in verse 8 is to finally bring them out of Egypt, to bring them into a good land, a land that flows with milk and honey, a land presently being occupied by 10 different Canaanite tribes, five of which are mentioned by name here. And in verse 9, notice, God took knowledge of their affliction. The cry of the children of Israel has come unto me. I've seen the oppression wherewith the Egyptians oppressed them. And so the means of redemption is to be the means of Moses in verse 10. Moses will be sent to Pharaoh, and Moses to bring the children of Israel out of Egypt. Now, when he was 40 years old, he was quite anxious to become Israel's deliverer. And his first act was killing the Egyptian overseer that was mistreating one of the Jewish slaves. However, he found himself being rejected by his own people, which disappointed him enough to leave the land of Egypt. At the age of 40, he was quite active, quite willing, quite anxious to be Israel's deliverer. At the age of 80, he's not so anxious anymore. So as the outline shows, he raises five different objections that God has to answer before he finally takes on the task. And the first objection is in verse 11, who am I that I should do such a thing? He's got an identity crisis now. Who am I that I should do such a thing for you? And the answer in verse 12 is, I will be with you. And the evidence, token, sign is, you will know that I have sent you when you and the whole nation will worship me at this very mountain. Now Mount Sinai, there are two possible locations, one in South Sinai, one in the Western Negev today, but neither identification of where Mount Sinai is located is on the direct path between Egypt and the land of Canaan. It's a very roundabout trip to get there. As the evidence for Moses is that when he stands before this mountain again, and all the Jewish people will be standing before him, that will be the evidence that indeed this was God's divine call. And that should be sufficient. Not so with Moses. Capital D, we have the second objection answer in chapter 3, verses 13 to 22. The objection is in verse 13, the people will not believe me. They want to know the name of the one who sent me. And in verses 14 and 15, God's answer is to provide that name. And God said to Moses, I am that I am. And he said, thus shall you send the children of Israel, I am, hath sent me unto you. Normally, God's name appears as a verb in the third person, and the closest English equivalent would be Yahweh, Y-A-H-W-E-H, Y-A-H-W-E-H, has the basic meaning, one who causes to be, one who causes to be, and always in the third person. Here is the one place his name appears with the same root, but in the first person, and it comes out as I am that I am. And so God's name is always is actually a verb, emphasizing he's always an active God, unlike the images in Egypt. Egypt had a sizable pantheon. And in verse 15, this is God's memorial name. And so Moses being sent by the same God who called Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he specifies, this is my name forever. This is my memorial name unto all generations. And this name emphasizes God in two facets. First of all, he's the God of redemption. But secondly, and more often, he is the covenant-keeping God. Emphasizes God as the covenant keeper. Only God has these four Hebrew letters of his name. That's important because in the debate, various cultic groups tend to deny the deity of the Son. In Jeremiah chapter 23, verses 5 and 6, Jeremiah 23, verses 5 and 6, one of Messiah's name is Jehovah, YHVH, Yahweh. And the fact that the Messiah also has this name means he must be God. Only God can have this name in all four letters. Now, verses 16 to 22, he also spells out the program of redemption. The first stage in verse 16 and 17 is to appear before the elders of Israel, now in Egypt. He seemed to tell the elders, I've been sent by the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God has seen what has been done in Egypt, and God will bring you out of the affliction of the land. And after identifying himself to the Jewish elders, in verse 18, he's to go before Pharaoh himself and to appear before Pharaoh with the elders of Israel. And also the request is kept simple. The request is simply, verse 18, to allow Israel to go 3 days in the wilderness and to sacrifice to God. Notice the simple request. There is no statement about leaving the land of Egypt permanently. Obviously, verse 18 is not the ultimate purpose. But the point is, if Pharaoh was willing to accept the offer and let Israel simply go for 3 days, then by obligation, Israel would have to have come back into enslavement. But God knows what Pharaoh will do. And so he simply presents the request quite minimal, leaving Pharaoh without any excuse for the plagues he will suffer and finally losing the slave trade that he's been depending upon. He also refers to God as the God of the Hebrews in verse 18. And the word Hebrew is normally used when Jews identify themselves to Gentiles. As for example, when Jonah was asked, who are you? He said, I am a Hebrew. And the sailors were not Jewish. And as we've seen, they often use the term, I am a Hebrew, in the very special cases, with some rare exceptions. When they identify themselves to Gentiles, they don't call themselves Israelites or Jews, but simply as Hebrews. In verse 19 and 20, God lets Moses know there's no possibility they'll only go for 3 days because in verse 19, Pharaoh will refuse the offer. And in verse 20, that refusal by Pharaoh is going to open the door for God smiting Egypt with the plagues, a special punishment upon the Egyptians because of the enslavement, and carry out the cursing facet of the Abrahamic covenant, I will curse them that curse you. And furthermore, in verses 21 and 22, they'll also lead to the despoiling of Egypt. And the Egyptians will become so fearful of Israel, they'll gain sight in the sight of the Egyptians, they'll gain favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And so when Israel leaves as a freed people, they'll also leave as a wealthy people. And this too was part of the promise of the Abrahamic covenant in Genesis chapter 15, verse 14. In Genesis 15, 14 said, they'll come out with great substance, and so they will. You would think that would be sufficient, but no. Capitally, in chapter 4, verses 1 through 9, we come to the third objection and answer. The objection is in verse 1, they will refuse to believe me. They simply won't believe me. So what God does now is provide three signs for Moses to use in verses 2 through 9. The first sign in verses 2 through 5 is the turning of the rod into a snake. He's got his shepherd's rod simply thrown on the ground, it'll become a living snake. And the purpose is they may see that God did send Moses. And furthermore, there's a second sign in verses 6 through 8, the leper's hand. And the purpose of the second sign is to use it if the first sign fails. You take his hand, put it inside the clothes of his bosom, and when it comes out again, it's leprous. Put it again, out again, it'll be healed. If the first two signs are still unconvincing, he'll give them a third sign in verse 9, turning water into blood. These are three signs he could use. There'll be some other miracles once he's in Egypt. But the three key purposes for these signs. First of all, to strengthen the faith of Moses. Moses is reluctant to carry out the commission. The better things we would choose to do. So strengthen his faith, he's given these three things to do. Secondly, to authenticate the mission of Moses to the Jewish people in Egypt. This will authenticate his calling to be Israel's physical redeemer. But thirdly, to show Pharaoh the superiority of the God of Israel, to show the Pharaoh and his leaders the superiority of the God of Israel. And indeed, God is not merely judging the government of Egypt, he's going to judge the gods of Egypt. Against all the gods of Egypt will I judge. And there's over 70 different gods and goddesses in the Egyptian pantheon that we know about, over 70. And every plague is against one or more gods and goddesses. Every plague is aimed against one or more gods and goddesses. Now the question arises, didn't some of the miracles of Moses get repeated by the Egyptian magicians? The answer is yes. For example, when Moses threw his rod and became a snake, the Egyptian magicians threw on their rods, also became snakes. And I think the text indicates it was fakery. It really did become snakes by satanic power. And so on. But they began, but they're only able to duplicate it so far. For example, Moses brought up dust from the ground. The Egyptian magicians were able to also bring up, frogs from the dust of the ground. The magicians were also able to bring up more frogs from the dust of the ground. They duplicated the miracle. However, if they wish to show the superiority of the gods of Egypt, what they should have done is remove the frogs that Moses brought forth. And the principle is that while Satan can duplicate some of divine miracles, what he cannot do is undo a divine miracle. He can duplicate some miracles. He cannot undo a divine miracle. And at that point, the last thing the Egyptians needed was more frogs. And I suspect that when the Egyptians saw their own magicians bringing more frogs up from the ground, they were ready to croak themselves. But that's the nature. Duplication is one thing. Removal of a divine miracle is quite another. Still does not satisfy Moses. And so, capital F, he raises his fourth objection in chapter 4, verses 10 through 12. His fourth objection is, I'm not eloquent. I'm not a great speaker. And the answer of God in verse 11 and 12 is simply a good rhetorical question. Who made man's mouth? And the same God who made the mouth of Moses will also teach Moses what he has to say. So him being, whether he's eloquent or not, is irrelevant to the issue. Then comes the fifth objection answer in verses 13 through 17. The objection is in verse 13, Lord, send someone else. I don't want to do this job. Send someone else. And the answer in verses 14 through 17 is a bit more graphic. This time God gets angry. And Moses feels the anger. And furthermore, God tells Moses, Aaron, who is the brother of Moses, hadn't seen him 40 years, is coming out to look for Moses, let him know that Pharaoh that sought his life is now dead. He'll be glad to see Moses. And Aaron happens to be a good speaker with a good voice. And in verses 15 and 16, Aaron will function as the spokesman of Moses. So Moses will take the rod. He'll be given the commands of God. Aaron's role will be to become the spokesman for Moses. Well, after feeling God's anger, Moses feels he has no more objections to give. And so in verses 18 through 31, this is Kaplan, your outline, we come to the account of his departure for Egypt. He first goes back to the encampment of Jethro, his father-in-law, to make sure he gets the okay from Jethro. After all, this is Jethro's flock he's watching. Mm-hmm. A permission was necessary since Jethro was the head of the house. And while he's back in Midian, in verse 19, God again tells him, return to Egypt. All the men are dead who sought your life. In the past 40 years, those who wanted to kill him are now gone. In verse 20, he does leave for Egypt, and notice he takes his family, Zipporah and her two sons, and he also took what is now called the rod of God. And on the way, he gets a third message from God in verses 21 through 23, Moses to perform all the wonders he was shown before Pharaoh in Egypt. But in verse 21, notice God will harden Pharaoh's heart. He will not let Israel go. In English, the same word is always used, but the three different Hebrew words used, all by the English word hardened. 10 times it says God will harden the heart of Pharaoh. 4 times Pharaoh hardened his own heart. And 6 times it simply says Pharaoh's heart was hardened and keeps it neutral. Now, what Paul draws from this in Romans chapter 9, verses 14 and 15, Romans 9, 14 and 15 is this. Men are not hardened by God so that they could be lost. Men are not hardened by God so they could be lost. Men are lost, and they are hardened. They are hardened because they already are lost, not in order to be lost. And the message is to present to Pharaoh, spelled out in verses 22 and 23, Israel is my son, my firstborn. And Israel as a nation is the firstborn son with the firstborn rights. But in verse 23, because Pharaoh has refused to let Israel go, God will now slay Pharaoh's firstborn. And indeed, God will send 10 plagues upon the Egyptians. The final plague will be the death of the firstborn son all over the land of Egypt. And what we here see is again a principle of the Abrahamic covenant. While it is curse for curse and kind, there's also a principle that God will not only give curses for curses, but they'll be in kind, meaning the way the Jew is cursed, God will take the same curse and apply it to ones doing the cursing. The curse of Egypt against Israel was the death of the sons of Israel, and now God will send 10 plagues upon the Egyptians, and the 10th plague will be the death of the firstborn son of every firstborn in Egypt. And that is curse for curse in kind. And there are many other examples throughout Scripture of this principle. This is only one of them. Now, the way now, notice then Moses now being obedient. He's finally heading back to Egypt. He's doing what God called him to do. And there's a strange incident in verses 24 to 26, capital J, the circumcision incident. Because Jews practiced circumcision, Midianites were a group that did not practice circumcision. And for some reason, which we'll get into in a moment, Moses failed to circumcise apparently his second son. One son apparently was circumcised, one was not. Now apparently he did circumcise his firstborn son, which she didn't like what she saw, and so the second son was born. She didn't want the second son circumcised, and Moses acquiesced. In place of exercising headship, he acquiesced and didn't have a second son circumcised. What that means is that placed Moses in disobedience to the Abrahamic covenant. Because Genesis 17, the sign of the covenant was circumcision. And chapter 17 also said that those who don't circumcise their sons will be cut off from among his people. So as we already noted, at the end of chapter 2, the basis for rescuing Israel out of Egypt was on the basis of the Abrahamic covenant. But now how could he use someone that was being disobedient to the same covenant? How could he use someone being disobedient to the same covenant? And so what happens, he inflicts him with some kind of a plague, as the word often means, that makes Moses immovable. His wife Zipporah recognizes what the situation is, and although she does not want to do it to save the life of Moses, she picks up a flintstone and circumcises her second son, and by so doing, saved her husband's life. But she's still not happy about it, and she keeps calling him a bloody bridegroom, a bloody bridegroom. She was half Midianite and half British. Now, as a result of her animosity on this issue, she doesn't get to go to Egypt. She's sent back to Midian with her two sons. We know this because when Moses arrives at Mount Sinai, Jethro, his father-in-law, has to bring his wife to him. As a result, she's sent back and she does not see the miracles of God in Egypt. She does not see the supernatural deliverance of Israel. She fails to see all these things because of her opposition to the issue. And finally, in this section, verses 27 through 31, we have the account of the meeting of Aaron and then with the elders of Israel. Initially, notice there was acceptance. Initially, they accept him joyously, but things will change. Let me make some comments about the aftermath. Turn now to chapter 5. Chapter 5. After the first encounter with Pharaoh, which he appeared before the elders of Israel, it led to, in place of acceptance of Moses by the elders, to rejection. Verse 20, and they met Moses and Aaron, who stood in the way, and they came forth from Pharaoh, and said to him, Jehovah look upon you and judge, because you made our savor to be abhorred in the eyes of Pharaoh, in the eyes of his servants, and put a sword in their hand to slay us. So the acceptance at the end of chapter 4 leads to rejection in the chapter 5 because there is initial failure of bringing any deliverance. Which of course also makes Moses wonder whether he's really responding to a divine call. And Moses does the right thing in chapter 5 verse 22 and 23. He points out to God, it's worse for the people now than before I came, so why did you send me? And God's answer in chapter 6, verse 1. Now shall you see what I will do to Pharaoh, for by a strong hand shall he let them go, and by a strong hand shall he drive them out of his land. And he points out to Moses, this initial rejection was necessary for the greater work that I will do. And he intends to fulfill that covenant. Verse 2. And God spoke unto Moses, and to him, I am Jehovah. I appear unto Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as God Almighty. But by my name Jehovah is not known unto them. This creates a problem, simply because we read in Genesis that they often refer to God by his actual name. But again, there's two different Hebrew words for knowing. There is one Hebrew word that's simply to know with intelligence, to know by the mind. But again, the second Hebrew word, as we mentioned earlier, is to know by experience. And the patriarchs did know God's name was Jehovah, Yahweh. They knew what that name was. But again, the name Yahweh emphasizes God as a covenant-keeping God and did not experience the meaning of that name. And so they experienced God as El Shaddai. God Almighty is the one who can make a covenant. Did not experience him as one who could fulfill that covenant. But now the experience will come, and now they will understand the kind of God they're worshiping, the kind of God that's heading them, an experiential God that can intervene and bring them out of situations with very magnanimous miracles. Now turn to Numbers 12. In Numbers 12, Moses married a second wife, and based upon the Hebrew word, she was a black wife, and that raised the ire of his brother and sister. So Miriam and Aaron began to feel they're just as much prophets as Moses was, because they were, and maybe even better, because they wouldn't have done such a thing. And God says in verse 4, And Jehovah spoke suddenly unto Moses, and unto Aaron, and unto Miriam, Come out, ye three, into the tent of meeting. And the three came out, and Jehovah came down in a pillar of cloud, and stood at the door of the tent, and called Aaron and Miriam, and they both came forth. And he said, Hear now my words. If there be a prophet among you, I shall make myself known to him in a vision. I will speak to them in a dream. My servant Moses, not so. He is faithful in all my house. With him will I speak mouth to mouth, even manifestly and not in dark sentences, and the form of Jehovah shall he behold. Wherefore we are not afraid to speak against my servant, against Moses. That's the kind of prophet that Moses was, unique from all the prophets. Now with Moses, God spoke mouth to mouth, spoke face to face. Because God appeared to him visibly in many different forms. And while never saw God as he really is, he saw various manifestations of the visibility of God. And so he was a unique prophet, and no other prophet reached his status. Now keeping that in mind, look at Deuteronomy chapter 18. Deuteronomy chapter 18. Verse 15, Deuteronomy 18, verse 15, here we have one of those messianic prophecies. Jehovah your God raised up unto you a prophet from the midst of you, of your brethren unto me, unto him you shall hearken. And notice the prophet that God promises to raise unto other people will be like unto me, meaning like unto Moses. Verse 18, I raised them up a prophet from among their brethren like unto you, and I'll put my words in his mouth, he shall speak unto them all I shall command him, and shall come to pass whosoever shall not hearken unto my words, which I shall speak in my name, I will require it of him. God promises here is not merely the promise of raising up other prophets. This he said he would do early in chapter 13. But now he promises a special type of prophet, one that will be like unto Moses, to whom God speaks face to face and mouth to mouth. And so Moses becomes a type of the Messiah, in especially this one sense, being a prophet with whom God spoke face to face and mouth to mouth. And Jesus was that prophet, and during his first coming, he functioned in the office of a role of a prophet, and he too was someone whom God's Father spoke face to face, mouth to mouth, a unique prophetic calling. So Moses, who was initially reluctant, but once he was accepting the office, he took it with relish, and he never again argued with God against the role he played. He argued with God as belongs certain issues, but never about his own prophetic calling. But to draw some applications from this from us, I would say we should keep in mind that while all of us are also called to participate in the work of the Lord, all of us are called to help build up the local body of Christ, the local body of the Messiah. We're not all called to be leaders. And those who are called to be leaders are given the necessary gifts and so on. But secondly, leadership is a good thing to pursue, but requires maturity and requires the fulfillment of the requirements of leadership spelled out in 1 Timothy 3, and Titus chapter 1 for both elders and deacons. And God might give you a different type of ministry, though it's not a leadership role, but it might be a teaching role, a serving role, and things of that nature. And keep in mind that as you do the work of the ministry, in whatever position God has called you to, we're all called to do some work of the ministry. Acceptance is not necessarily a sign of divine calling. Acceptance is not necessarily a sign of divine calling. And rejection is not a sign of a lack of a divine calling. What we feel to do, we should carry on. We might find acceptance, we might find rejection, but our authority to do these things comes from the one that's called us. And we must do it to honor him and for his glory and not for our own. To keep that in mind, other people's acceptance and rejection right by itself would not shake us so badly.